From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made on Tuesday evening when the Monroe County Board of Elections completed its counting of absentee ballots. Monroe County and New York State had waited to count absentee ballots by design, making sure all of the ballots had come in. And as the rest of the country counted absentee ballots, it was obvious the Democratic Party had an advantage everywhere. The question was, how big an advantage? Well, the race seemed to be hanging in the balance in our area was the 135th Assembly District, a seat that had been filled in the past decade by Republican Mark Johns. He was challenged by a Democrat, Jen Lunsford, who nearly won a New York State Senate seat 2 years ago. And on election night, Johns was up by more than 10 percentage points. But it was clear the final result would be very close. It turns out after tens of thousands of voters had all of their voices counted in this race, Jen Lunsford won the seat by 684 votes. Less than one percentage point, but enough, no recount needed. Lunsford goes to the New York State Assembly. She joins a group of local Democrats that are among the youngest local Democratic leadership in the country, and that is a stark contrast to Democrats on the national stage, where Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have maintained their leadership positions for many years. We see Joe Biden, of course, in the presidency. This hour, it's a chance to talk to Jen Lunsford about her victory, what it means for the region, what it means for her party, and for New York State. Assemblywoman-elect Jen Lunsford, welcome to the program. How are you?
Very good. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, you and I talked a little bit after the election, and you wanted to wait because you knew this would be close. Though, if you could, can you take me through the last couple of weeks? Because one of the things I kept hearing on election night was that obviously everybody thought Democrats would do well with absentee. We can talk about why in a moment, but everybody knew that the party would do well. But for the most part, Republicans felt like if they were leading by double digits, they would hold on. It did not turn out to be the case here. What was your mindset on election night and in the ensuing days?
So we knew this was going to be close, and we knew it would come down to the absentees. I will admit that we did not expect the gap that we had on election night. We expected to be down maybe 5 points. But there had been a substantially larger population of people voting on election day than anyone predicted, and I think that was true nationally. And then, you know, I have been in this position before. I knew when they were going to start counting the ballots and that we had a long wait in front of us. But I think, you know, as anyone looking at this could see, we knew it was going to come down to a few hundred votes in either direction. So these past 2 weeks, I would not wish on my worst enemy. I actually, my heart goes out to Mark and his team, who must have been in the same amount of stress that I was. I was basically drinking coffee and eating Tums for the past 2 weeks.
How much were you sort of doing math every time you saw Democratic results in? You know, I know Georgia is not Monroe County and upstate Western New York, and I know that Pennsylvania is not Western New York. But every time you saw those numbers that were being counted and tabulated and processed before us, were you thinking, okay, so they're getting X? I need to get why, you know, what are the likelihood? I mean, were you doing that?
We went full beautiful mind. It was crazy in my house. My husband's an engineer. We had spreadsheets, and I wasn't looking at Georgia. I was looking, I mean, I was taking what I could get. Having to process all of this while also dealing with the federal election was a whole nother level of stress. But New York State actually allowed counting to begin last Tuesday. So there were some counties, in fact, the majority of counties began opening ballots last week. And I was able to get inside info from other candidates. I have John Mannion, Rachel May, Leslie Danks Burke, about how they were performing on the absentees versus the early vote, because that was the real question. I had 61.5% on the early vote, and most people wouldn't know that because the only way you got that information was if you were watching the polling places coming in and you took a screenshot of the first minute when they dropped all of the early vote results at once.
Yep.
So I was seeing, and this is fascinating. If there's any political scientists listening, I would love for you to study this. Consistently in every race I looked at, everyone was improving in the absentees over the early votes by 4%. And that's exactly what happened to me. And that's exactly what happened to Judge Chaccio.
Wow.
A pretty consistent 4% bump.
Yeah, I should say Judge Chaccio also had a close race that I'm uncomfortable with some of the headlines, I admit, that I'm seeing. I mean, I respect my colleagues across this region, but some of the headlines, you know, sort of, I I don't have them in front of me, Jen, but they were saying things like, you know, after absentees come in, so-and-so loses lead or something. I mean, like, really what happened here is we just counted all the votes. And
it's a fascinating function of the way we as humans narratively tell stories to ourselves, as if this was something that happened afterwards, when, of course, many of these absentees were cast months ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the military ballots, they were the earliest ones to go out, and they were the last ones to come in. So we look at these as if they happened linearly, when in reality, this everyone was having Schrodinger's election, where we had both won and lost, and we were just waiting to be observed.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way to describe it. I mean, I think the national media did a pretty good job in the presidential race, understanding that by election night, we were going to see big gaps, whether it was Biden ahead and Trump vote coming in, or Trump ahead and Biden vote coming in later. That seemed to be pretty clear. On these races, though, state races, I think that was less clear. People saw the initial numbers and thought, oh, well, you know, Mark won, or, you know, so-and-so won, or whatever the case is. So it was obvious that this race was going to be close. But if you had 61% of the early vote, what was the number in mind that you needed to, what did you need to get to win by one vote? Was it 61, 62%?
It was 63.5 to have like a fair margin.
Okay.
Of like, not one vote, but like less than 100 votes. And I ended up with 65%.
Wow. To me, that simply says that for the length of this pandemic, when you have national Republican leadership telling people, anyone who will listen, that mail-in votes can't be trusted, absentee can't be trusted, even though he has voted by mail for years, of course, and most of the top Republicans have, but whatever, and also that the pandemic is not, you know, an actually dangerous thing, that just vote in person, that's fine. It's not a surprise that the numbers ended up being this way, at least not to me. How did you see it?
Yeah, we expected there to be a more right-leaning vote on Election Day, not just because of that rhetoric, but because we have generally seen, and this is, of course, a gross overstatement, that, you know, more people who are concerned about COVID are lefter-leaning voters this cycle. So people who may have, you know, been more concerned about going to the polls. But also, Republicans are amongst the most consistent voting bloc. They wake up, brush their teeth, and vote. And many people, frankly, including me, enjoy the ritual of Election Day.
Yeah.
The going down en masse, the collegial feel of participating in democracy. And I think that there may have been more right-leaning voters that said, you know, not, beyond even early voting, that they very much wanted to do this on Election Day. So I think that that's a function of part of what we've seen. Also, amongst the population of people that would have early voted, this is all anecdotal, but I was hearing from people that some of the early voting sites were just too far from their house. And they're like, hey, I can walk down to my polling place or I can vote by mail. I'm not going to drive, you know, halfway across the city or, you know, up all the way up to the recreation center in Webster when I can just put something in the mail. So I think that that also suppressed some of the early vote we otherwise would have gotten as well.
Yeah. So last question on this, and then we're going to talk about some issues. But when it comes to 2 days ago, you know, for those of us in journalism, we were waiting for Tuesday night. And I'm wondering if you had any signal by Tuesday morning, by midday. I mean, what was the process like for you to be told, hey, this is swinging in your favor, or the votes are going to be there? I mean, was there just one phone call, or was it like, hang tight, it looks good? How was it going?
So we were getting no information at all about the count. And the story we'd been told was that nothing would be released until the full count was done. So we were like, all right, we're not getting anything until Wednesday. And then I had, you know, people down there watching, and they were like, well, this is actually going pretty fast. They're doing, and can I just compliment the Board of Elections
for
the Herculean effort of everything that they did to make this work smoothly. Obviously, this was a much simpler election than the primary, where there were, you know, multiple ballots and where we were dealing with, you know, this mass mail-in for the first time. But they did an outstanding job. I applaud everyone involved. Thank you all so much for making me as a candidate feel really secure in the process. That I didn't think for a moment there were any shenanigans. I don't think anybody else did.
Jen, when we look around the country, obviously, I'm concerned about what's happened in Wayne County, Michigan, but when you look at Georgia's Secretary of State, Nevada, Arizona, no matter where we're talking about outside of Wayne County, Michigan, I have seen leadership in both political parties really take this job with such intense integrity and devotion. Understanding that, I mean, as the Secretary of State in Georgia said yesterday, he said, I'm a Republican. I'm not thrilled with these results, but I'm not going to change them. I'm not going to let it be tampered with. And we should sort of be sickened that there's been any pressure on Republican leadership to do that. But by and large, this election has reinforced my confidence in the people who run elections and the way it's done in this country. I don't know how you feel, but it sounds like you feel largely the same.
I do. I think that the overwhelming majority of people are Americans first, and that we know that our vote is sacred, and we take very seriously the experience of voting and the duty to vote. And it's really reinforced for me that we're a strong country. As divided as we are going to look back at this time as a moment where we came together and collectively made the right decision to save our country from a very disastrous path that we easily could have fallen into had we not all been working so hard for the last 4 years. So if anything, I think as divided as we are, this reiterates the strength of our country.
All right, so let's wrap up Tuesday night. Did you get one phone call, and when did it come? What was it like?
So I had a team down there. I got told around 4:30 that they had made the decision to tell us the scan results when they were done. So they were like, well, they're still going to be hand count, but we'll tell you the results.
Oh, man.
The scan.
Man.
So I literally, like, I went to full, like, my stomach hurt. And then I got mixed information, like, it'll be out by 8, it'll be out by 5, it'll be out by 7, it'll be out by 6. Nobody knew. I had, like, 3 separate people who all told me they were going to get the inside line. I got the information maybe 5 minutes before it went live online as a courtesy so that I would have a moment before my phone started to ring. I got one phone call. I'm not going to tell you who it was from.
Okay.
And it was a very kind individual who cut right to the chase and said, you won by 700 votes.
Wow.
At which point I knew that no matter what the result would be, I would just cry from the relief of knowing, because it had been so very stressful not to know. I got a then call from Speaker Hastie, who was like, are you crying? And I'm like, it's been very stressful. You don't understand. So it was a rush from, I think, man, that was, I don't even know what time it was anymore, maybe 6:55.
Yeah, okay. And my understanding is that Mark Johns called you last night. Is that right?
I am not going to say he did not call me. However, I have not gotten a call. He does not have my phone number. He may have called my campaign line, and my campaign phone was dead in the backseat of my car. And I just honestly have been working and have not checked. So it is wholly possible that he did call, and I just have not gotten the message yet.
Ah, interesting, because it looks like he has made a formal concession at least, but you haven't spoken to him.
Yes.
Okay. And, you know, Mark has always been very accessible on this program. I suspect we'll still hear from him, and I hope we do. You know, have you found that a political campaign, it's hard to maintain, you know, a cordial relationship when you're trying to knock somebody out of the ballot box, or how do you feel about that relationship?
Well, this cycle was, I think, particularly different because normally we would have interacted more. We would have been at parades together. We would have appeared at more events together, and we would have had more time to be together in a room. As it was, the only face-to-face conversation I had with Mark this entire cycle was the 2 minutes before our televised debate and the time I spoke to him on the phone here with you. And that was really it. I never saw him. I have spoken more to Mark prior to running against him, and I've always found him to be, you know, an affable, collegial person. He has been, you know, very gracious as the results came in. I honestly can't imagine how difficult that must have been for him to have such a big reversal. I've actually been thinking a lot about him and his staff and how hard that must have been. But, you know, Mark, I truly believe, is a public servant. I disagree with his politics, and I disagree with, you know, I think his tactics in terms of how he approaches government. But I don't think he is a bad guy, and I think that he was in government for the right reasons, and I hope that I can continue in his legacy of being a public servant.
Sure.
And serving everyone to the best of my ability, whether they voted for me or not.
Well, 684 votes is not, you know, 10, 50, 100 votes that looks likely to change if there were a recount. But at the same time, we've got a president who's still tweeting, "I won Michigan," when he lost by a few hundred thousand votes. "I won Georgia. I won Wisconsin." Yeah. Well, I never thought I'd be asking a question like this, but is it at least a relief to have an opponent say, "Hey, congratulations, you won this"?
It is very nice to be running in an election with a foreign adult.
Wow.
And Mark is a professional person.
Yeah, he is, yeah.
You know, I think that it helps probably a little bit that he's near the end of his career, you know, that he you know, was planning on retiring next term anyway. So that's probably got to be a little bit easier for him and his family.
Talking to Jen Lunsford, the winner in the 135th New York State Assembly race, and that was officially confirmed on Tuesday evening after the full tabulation of absentee ballots. She wins by just about 700 votes in a race. How many total votes were there? Do you remember offhand?
Somewhere around 84 and change. We still don't have the hand count. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the turnout was obviously enormous. I've spoken to some other people, speaking to an assembly person who was behind in Buffalo recently, and she only had 11,000 absentees to count. So, you know, I was down by 10 points on election night, but I actually haven't run the math on what that actually was in terms of the total vote. We have 24,000 absentee ballots, yeah. So four times the amount of the spread.
Yeah, that's a lot. And that's the way a lot of the country voted. And a lot of those trends showed up here when Democrats were much more comfortable and happy to vote absentee. And so as Jen Lunsford gets ready to go to Albany, I want to talk a little bit about the way the Democratic Party is now reflected locally versus nationally. And, you know, the party this week in Washington decided to keep Nancy Pelosi as speaker. You've got Chuck Schumer there. Joe Biden, of course, will be the oldest elected president. And I am not bringing this up in a way that intends to be ageist. I mean, there is obviously tremendous leadership and wisdom possible from anyone of just about any age. But when you look at the way Democrats have generally governed on the national stage recently, some of the critics this week, Matt Stoller, David Dayne, among others, they've been writing that national Democrats have prevented the next generation or two of leadership from emerging and sort of taking the reins and getting used to calling the shots. And that's made it harder for the party to kind of groom and grow leadership when you know, when you've got decades and decades and decades of the same people in the same positions. Do you see it that way on the national stage?
Well, certainly federally. And I think that's part of a function of the way legislative government works. Legislative government is a government by cooperation. You need to build coalitions and cooperation. And your ability to do that increases over time. And your, you know, currency is your reputation and your ability to, you know, garner favor from people often, you know, who oppose you. So I think it's natural that the leadership in the legislature would be older because they would just have more of that currency. There's also, of course, the natural momentum of incumbency and hesitancy, I think, of institutional donors to support non-incumbents. It's a very deep and complex problem why people are able to remain in office as long as they are. And that's heavily, I think, contingent on money. But I think that we right now and in the last 4 years have been in a rebuilding time for the Democrats, that we are building a bench. I am that bench. You know, we're seeing younger people coming in. And I think that's also a function of people like me who has a small child, has a full-time professional job, saying I am willing to take the risk to do this. It, historically, someone like me at this point in my life doesn't run for office. Someone like, you know, AOC doesn't run for office at that stage in her life. And a lot of us are saying, you know, if not now, when?
Has anyone ever told you publicly or privately that you shouldn't run because you have a young child?
almost everybody.
I mean, even in your own party?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I think worse from my own party.
Wow.
Worse from women, worse from older women.
Wow.
And I have had older women say to me that they even recognize the bias that's making them say it. But I had a older woman Democrat say to me at one point in 2019 that when she started seeing my commercials and ads and saw how small my son was, he was 15 months when I announced the first time, that her thought was, how could she do that to her baby? And I was like, you know, and that cuts me right to my core, because of course I have those thoughts too about how I have to leave my son to travel to Albany. But there are lots of parents who travel half the year who leave their child, and I would leave my child with his father. You know, it's not like I'm leaving with a stranger. It's his dad.
You're leaving him at the bus stop. There you go.
Yeah, like it's fine. But I think, like, as a mom, there's a lot of guilt around that. But that, you know, the legislative session is only 6 months a year. It's not 5 days a week most of the time. It's really only 65 nights a year. And this cycle, I've been told, is going to be heavily remote. So I'm going to be working from my house anyway.
Yeah. And I don't want to get bogged down too much into the, like, oh, you're a woman and you won. How amazing. But but at the same time, I'm thinking of a conversation with Judy Woodruff from PBS, who was in the 1970s. She was considering a career in journalism or a career working on Capitol Hill. And what she has said in her book is she decided in her 20s, in the 1970s, pretty quickly, I'm not doing it. I don't like the way women are treated in Washington. Now, that was the 1970s. I don't know if that's perfectly reflected in Albany, but she has said she has never regretted that decision, watching the ensuing decades of how women are treated in Washington. Do you think things have changed in politics, generally speaking, for women, whether you're elected or working as a staff member, et cetera?
It's changed, but it's slow, and I don't think it's changed as fast as it has in the private sector. You know, as I'll tell you, I'm certain that if I was a man, people wouldn't be asking me who was going to watch my son when I was in Albany.
Sure.
And I get asked that question a lot. And I am, you know, blessed to have a very, very supportive and involved spouse who has been cooking me dinner for years now. He took over all of the meal planning. He does a lot of the housework. And he has a, you know, full-time plus job as well. If I did not have such an equal partner, I would not be able to do what I do. And I know that a lot of women still don't have that kind of partner. So when they think of their own marriage, they think, how could someone do that? But I have a very feminist husband, so I'm very lucky. There's still biases, but I think once you're in there, people don't necessarily discount women's opinions as they once did. I won't be expected to champion only women's issues. And I think maybe even 10 years ago, people would have expected a woman to come in and, you know, sit on the education committee or sit on the, you know, children and families committee. You know, if I get up there and I'm like, hey, I've been in insurance law for 10 years, I know some things about insurance, no one's going to tell me that I shouldn't.
Yeah, I take the point. Why do you think the Democratic Party locally has been successful now in, maybe I should rephrase this. The Democratic Party has younger leadership now than the Democratic Party in a lot of different places, from yourself, Damon Meeks, Sarah Clark, Adam Bello, Jamie Romeo, Beatrice LeBrun. I'm going to miss somebody. I should stop counting names. But there are a lot of under 40. There's a lot of under 45. It's not, and again, that's not to malign older leadership. It's just looking at trend lines. And I have had conversations in recent years before some of the shift with people like Beatrice LeBrun, who talked about how difficult it can be to sort of even crack into the party structure, and that the Democratic Party is kind of hierarchical and wait your turn in line, and no, this is not your time to run for this seat, or we'd like you to wait. That doesn't seem to have been the case in this election cycle. I wonder if that has happened with sort of the consent of, I should say Zach King, by the way, is 27, the chair of the local party. The whole slate, by the way, in leadership in the local party. So has that been sort of by design now that this shift has happened? Or has that been candidates like yourself saying, damn it, I'm doing it anyway. I don't care who says no.
This has been a fascinating 4 years. And I think if you go down to places like Long Island, where they have an extremely tight hold on elections, there's, you know, warring factions everywhere, but you got to be bequeathed on Long Island. Here, through a series of events that were beyond everybody's control, the passing of Louise Slaughter, the passing of David Gantt, the literal removal of people who were strong voices in the local party. Joe Morelli ascending to Washington and, you know, being a little bit more removed has opened the playing field to more people. There's just the traditional two parts of the Democratic Party here who were jockeying for position. The mesh opened and it let the progressives through. And I think a lot of us happened to be rising into our power at that time. We're feeling motivated because of what was happening federally. And the stars kind of just aligned to allow a lot of new people who were newly motivated to the system to enter into the playing field because of some coincidental things that happened. It would be a much longer conversation about what exactly occurred to allow this situation to happen. But I'm very glad that there are leaders like Sarah and Demond and Samra and Jeremy who have stepped up and said, I'm willing to do this in this moment. Because if we weren't here ready to take the reins, they would have just fallen down.
Is the narrative that for a long time, even in local politics, the Democratic Party has been very much sort of a, you need the blessing to run, wait in line, not your turn. Did those things, was that a fair narrative for a long time?
I think it was. And of course, you know, it depends on the race as well. And it's, you could have run, but you would have lacked the kind of support you needed. And I say this as someone who had enormous support this cycle from institutional people. I was the number one flip target for the Democratic Assembly Campaign Committee. They spent more money on my race. And that was a function of local people like Adam, like Harry, like Joe, all rallying behind me to help lift me up. So I recognize that I have benefited from that system in ways that some other progressive candidates have not. But I also came from wholly outside of politics. If I had run into Joe Morelli in the supermarket in 2015, I wouldn't have known his face because he wasn't my assembly person. And that's just not where I was politically paying that close attention to local politics. So I had to build a lot of this myself, but I was able to get in touch with the right people to help me find out where I needed to go. So I don't want to act like I built this by myself or, you know, I'm some self-made person. As a result of the hard work that we put in and demonstrating to people that we could lift ourselves up and we could do the right thing, we were able to garner support from institutional people who were able to help.
I got a couple more questions on sort of the nitty-gritty of campaigning, because now after two different races, 2018 and 2020, you lost a close one, you won a close one, and you've got tremendous experience with how the process works. And you just mentioned that in 2015, you wouldn't even have recognized Joe Morelli if you bumped into him in the grocery store. And now here you are going to the New York State Assembly. You're going to be working with Democrats like him on different initiatives. You're a voice in this party who probably the sky's the limit, depending on what you want to do in the future. So it's interesting in 5 years how much can change. For listeners who think, well, that'll never be me, but that would be cool if it were me. What are the steps that you got to start taking to think about how you do something like this?
So don't do it like I did, because what I did was crazy. What I did was answer a call to service. I was somewhat interested in running from, you know, people telling me, hey, you should run. Hey, you should run for probably a full year. I often say the average woman needs to be asked 7 times to run for office, and I need to be asked 70. And it just so happened that my friend Heather, who became my treasurer, was friends with Jamie Romeo, who was the chair of the party at the time. She sat me down with Jamie, and Jamie convinced me in an hour-long conversation to run for state senate. There are other seats. There are smaller seats that are much smaller lips. I also had a small baby and a full-time job. To say that this hasn't been the hardest thing I've ever done and that it took its toll on me personally, on my health personally, I don't want to make it seem like this is something people should feel like, oh, of course I can do that. And I say that because women put a lot of pressure on themselves to be everything. And when we can't be everything, we feel like we've failed. And I think that does a disservice to women. It's okay to not be everything because you can't have everything. You can have a little bit of everything or all of one thing. So I say that to caution people that this was really, really hard. But it's a thing you can do, and it's much easier if you don't have to raise as much money and you don't have to convince as many people. 2021 is going to have hundreds of open seats. Work with a candidate. Get some experience on a race. Knock some doors. Figure out what they're doing and see if it's the kind of thing you want to do. I think sometimes candidates run for office because they like the idea of running for office, but they don't know what the campaign is like, and they discover that they hate it. I've talked to more than one person that has discovered mid-campaign that it wasn't for them. Volunteer next year for a candidate, and really volunteer. You know, call them up. If you make eye contact long enough with someone, you'll be their campaign manager. That's the way those local elections work. So this is a great opportunity for people who are interested in dipping their toe in to get a feel for what it's really like.
Well, this will be instructive, though. What do you like most about campaigning?
I like people. You know, that's another thing. I think people run for office and don't realize that they don't like people till they're in it. I can point to, I think, a fair amount of elected officials, maybe one I ran against, who I think it was clear didn't like people. You have to really want to know more about an individual person. I love knocking doors, and I miss that so much this cycle. I love meeting different people and petting their dogs and, you know, talking about their gardens at their front doors. I like to talk to people. It's part of what I do in my regular job. I like house parties. So getting to meet thousands and thousands of people has been really motivating to me. It's what energizes me, and it's what keeps me, you know, enthusiastic about doing this.
Can I assume you were not talking about Mark Johns when you said...
I was not.
Okay. I think Mark likes people.
Mark
likes people, yeah. What did you like least about campaigning?
It's a slog. It's every day. Of course, you know, the fundraising is hard and boring. And, like, it's obviously the worst part because it's both hard and not immediately applicable to the actual doing of the job, to the stuff you do. And I know that that's also what keeps a lot of people out of politics, is this idea that you have to ask for money. Being a personal injury attorney, I asked for money professionally, so it was a little bit easier for me. But it's not fun, especially being on the phone. I would knock doors in the rain every day versus call banks. You also have to do it for so long. You know, it's your average campaign is 9-10 months long, and I've been running for 3 years. So the slowness of so much of it, you know, it's kind of like having a newborn where the days are long, but the years are short.
Interesting analogy there. Well, and then the other question I have on campaigning or everything you've done to get to this point, what has surprised you the most?
The enthusiasm from people who don't know me. The people who have said to me that they are voting for the first time because of me, or that they are voting down ticket for the first time because of me. I'm a very independent person, and the idea that I would inspire people, I guess, like, theoretically you think, of course, that's what politicians do, but when it actually happens to you, it is incredibly humbling. The people who have knocked doors for the first time or gotten involved in other political campaigns because I showed them what could be done, that has been the best part and the most surprising part and just incredibly meaningful to me.
We're coming right back after our only break of the hour with Jen Lunsford, elected to the New York State Assembly. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, the incoming Biden administration is considering wiping out some student loan debt, maybe up to $50,000 per person with that debt. That could impact a lot of people in this country, but there's been some pushback already. We examine the issue, wiping out student loan debt. Is it fair? Is it the right thing to do? And who benefits? That's Friday. My guest is Jen Lunsford, who is the newly elected, I should say, the Assembly member-elect in the 135th District, winning a close race against longtime incumbent Mark Johns. Mark Johns told us on this program that he is a centrist, that he's a Republican who often caucused or voted with Democrats. And some of your constituents have observed on social media that you won, but you won close. And Mark was a so-called centrist. So will you govern or will you legislate as a centrist, Jen Lunsford?
I don't think centrists are real. I think that's something someone says to make it seem like they aren't offensive to anybody. But I subscribe to the school of political thought that there's no such thing as the middle. No one has moderate views on healthcare or, you know, taxes. People just don't fall into one column or another. So they call themselves independent or they call themselves centrist because sometimes they take from column A and sometimes they take from column B. You know, I'm obviously a more progressive person, a more liberal person, but I'm also a highly practical person. And I think that comes from my years of working in an adversarial legal system. I represent everyone, whether they voted for me or not, and my door is always open. And my tact moving forward is to be open and transparent. I have pledged to have town halls, which, you know, we will figure out how to do in a pandemic, at least quarterly, to make sure that I have open office hours, that people aren't going to have to get through a gatekeeper to get to me. And I think in many ways, that's similar to what Mark did. Mark was well known for making a lot of his own phone calls, for, you know, personally calling people back. That is something people value. And it's the constituent work. That's, you know, that's why I got into government, is the constituent work. So to that extent, I think that I will be very similar to Mark in that way, though, of course, our political leanings are different. But I think that we all have the same goals. We just disagree about how to get there.
Well, can you envision 2 years from now, if you're running for re-election, some Republicans who did not vote for you saying, you know what, I like the work you've done and I'm going to cast a ballot for you?
I would hope so. I hope that the people whose vote I did not earn this cycle, I will be able to earn in the future.
How do you do it?
I think through being present, through having an open door, through listening, what I've seen myself as an activist, because I come from an activist background, from working in systems where you have to, you know, I'm going to use the word lobby, and I know from your Twitter feed, people don't like that word lobby, but lobby just means talking to your elected official
sure.
about issues, and regular people lobby. When people really start to turn against an elected official, it's when they appear unapproachable, or like they only listen to their donors, or like they are someone who isn't for the people. I hope that by demonstrating through my actions that I am here for the people of my district, regardless of their political affiliation, regardless of whether they voted for me, that I could show people that I am a voice for them who is fighting and advocating for their needs. Even again, if we disagree about tactic or we disagree about a value, that we all want safe schools, we all want to get through this pandemic, we all want everyone to be able to pay their bills and to have good jobs, we can disagree about what the best way to achieve those goals are. But as long as we share the goals, I think that we can come together.
Do you think, while centrists are maybe an invented term, is a political moderate a real thing?
I don't like moderate either. I think independent is the better term, just again, because you don't subscribe to A or B. And I think that far more people who have historically called themselves Republicans are finding themselves in a more independent stance because their party has run away from them. I feel very much for my friends, my family. People may be surprised to learn how many Republicans I am close to. And they are people who share a value system based on a more limited government, a more independent and I hate to use the phrase personal responsibility, but, you know, who believe that there should be less government interference in their lives. And they have watched their party get taken over by zealots and people who are bastardizing the thing that their party purports to be founded upon, and they don't know where to go.
Well, but let me ask you, do you think that, as you say, the bastardization, is that going in or the zealotry, is that going in the direction of social issues to the exclusion of others, or is it something else?
I think there's multiple places. I think what we've seen federally from certain federal level Republicans is an embracing of nationalistic and bigoted ideas. But if you really drill down, it's all about money. And it's all about, increasing power and funneling money upwards away from the people to the ultra wealthy. And I'm going to say a crazy thing. There's a part of me that almost feels a little bit bad for Donald Trump, because he was used by greedy men to fire up a base that would never benefit from their policies to get votes in for people who will line the pockets of billionaires. And that's what all of this has been. I don't think Donald Trump believes anything except that Donald Trump is important. I don't think he has an ethos other than greed. And I don't think most Americans agree with that. I don't think that Republicans stand for racism as a value system, but they've let their party take away the things that make Republicans strong in a way that they're going to have to heal from.
Well, let's spend the last few minutes then talking about the work that you want to do legislatively that, in your words, reaches people at all socioeconomic levels, especially those hurting the most, Republicans and Democrats, people in your district. And you're going to Albany at a time where it's going to be tighter. It's going to be harder. We can assume that the Biden administration will step in some degree and try to help states. But Mitch McConnell, depending on what happens in Georgia, could still have a ton of power to block a lot. And we're not sure what kind of aid Washington is going to provide to states, municipalities, et cetera. So with that in mind, your first year in office, realistically, what's on the menu? What can you do?
So I think, obviously, getting through this pandemic and rebuilding our economy are the only things we can expect to even start on, because this is an emergency. And I'm very excited to be going to Albany with a very strong coalition of Democrats who have vowed to work together, because so much of what we're going to do isn't just about bringing in funding to the district, but about protecting us from cuts, because the cuts are coming. And we need to protect our schools. We need to protect our healthcare. We need to protect people who need eviction and foreclosure protections, the most vulnerable among us. And I think that working together with our new state senators and with the new class of assembly people under the leadership of Harry Bronson, who we are extremely blessed to have, that we will be able to stand together and act as a bit of an umbrella for some of the worst things that can come. But we can't cut our way out of this problem. We need to find new revenue. And I'm a homeowner in Perrington. I pay an enormous amount of money in taxes. I understand we can't continue to burden middle-class homeowners. So we need to look to other ways to build revenue. I'm a big proponent of the ultra-millionaires tax. I'm a proponent of legalizing marijuana for the $300 million a year it will bring in. I think that we'll be able to open up some doors that have previously been closed in that regard, to help bring in new money. But I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time, too. We need to make sure that everyone who needs access to healthcare, not just for COVID, but for everything, can get it. People who are still unemployed can get their unemployment benefits for as long as they need to. That our small businesses can get the relief they need to keep their doors open and to safely operate. And that is going to be a Herculean effort.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the messaging that comes along with something like taxation, because when you talk about taxing the very, very wealthiest, and your colleagues do, often this becomes a partisan issue in which your colleagues who are Republicans will say, you see, that's all they want to do is tax, 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 even if you are only talking about taxing the very, very top tiny layer of wealthy individuals in a way that would not materially change their lives, but could help materially change the lives of other people who are really hurting. Even if that is the battle, it gets framed as they want to tax, we don't. And millions of Americans believe that. I mean, millions of Republicans believe that, even if those Republicans on Medicaid, oppose taxes on ultra-millionaires and billionaires. It's a very interesting thing. And I'm wondering what you see your role is in that. Is it communication? Is it, are you open to, I mean, do you think maybe it's the wrong idea, or do you think it's a narrative communication issue? What do you do with that?
So I think one of the things I did this cycle that I am proud of, and I would be proud of even if I had lost, is I ran the race I wanted to run. And that means that I was bold and I didn't shy away from things that were important. And part of that plan was to normalize the word tax. It was a risk for me to come out and say the word tax. I could have said revenue generators. I could have, and I sometimes still do. But that taxes are how we pay for our schools and our roads and our fire departments. People like rely on taxes. And we have let the Republican Party for too long turn words we use into curses. You know, we need to just be upfront and say, yeah, taxes are how we pay for things. And I want you to pay the same or less, and these other people who haven't been paying their fair share to pay more. And here's how I'm going to do it, and here's the impact it's going to have, and here's why I think it's important. The biggest problem Democrats have is that too many of our policies don't fit on a bumper sticker. We have been losing the messaging war for decades because we care so much that everyone understands how it works. And I'm guilty of this myself. Really caring that you understand how it works. And catchy slogans often don't encapsulate the complexity of what we're doing. So it is incumbent upon us to educate, to answer questions, and to not shy away from the reality that, yes, I'm talking about taxing people who make more than $5 million a year, roughly 2% more than they're currently taxed. And that even in the most robust and expansive of these plans, there's a couple different bills that propose an ultra-millionaire's tax, the top rate is still lower than the max top rate in New Jersey. It's not crazy. We just want people who make a lot of money to pay a little bit more.
Can when you've gone door to door talking to voters, when you talk to voters who self-identify as more conservative and you try to go through this idea with them, I mean, for those voters who said, are you going to raise my taxes or are you going to raise taxes? Do you feel yourself getting through when you take the time to explain it to them the way you just explained it here?
I do. I very often say, I'm not going to raise your taxes. Let me tell you who I'm going to raise taxes on. Someone will say, well, what's an ultra millionaire? And my joke is generally just south of whatever you make. But people like to know that we know how much things cost and that there are numbers attached to it. Because too often they hear tax and it just sounds like this amorphous taking. But when you attach real numbers to it and say, here's the math and let me show you why it works, they're open to that idea. And I'll tell you now that we're past the election that we pulled it and an overwhelming majority of people in our district support the ultra-millionaire tax. An overwhelming majority of people in New York State support the ultra-millionaire tax. Even Mark was saying he supported the ultra-millionaire tax because it works and people like it. And people, I think, are starting to really see the income inequality. I remember talking to someone at a bank manager. I was just doing my regular banking. We were chatting about politics. And he was saying, he's like, I cannot believe this income inequality. I cannot believe how much is centered at the top and how the people at the bottom don't see it. Mm. And, you know, that was someone literally in money for a living. We're starting to see people opening their eyes to what it means to be a billionaire. That number is cosmic to most people. They can't imagine it in terms of its actual relative size. So they don't understand how unequal it all is. Everyone thinks they are a billionaire in waiting. Mm.
All right. And 30 seconds and I'm done here. One more narrative that congressional Democrats have said hurt them was defund the police. Has that hurt the Democratic Party?
So I think that, again, it's a catchphrase and it doesn't encapsulate what they really mean. When people use that phrase, it's not a phrase that I use because I think it is limiting. I think it is confusing, but I'm not going to, I've been an activist for a long time. I'm not going to tell people how to market, but it's not a phrase that I use. I think it is a phrase that got taken very quickly by people who oppose the idea and turned into a caricature. People hear defund and they think take all money away, like when you say defund Planned Parenthood. I don't think that word is helpful, I think that we can do better when marketing that to people who are afraid of that term. But when you say, like, hey, I think we should spend more money on social workers and, you know, unarmed community
sure.
people, they're like, yeah, that makes sense to me. Democrats are bad at catchphrases.
I know we're going to talk a lot more, and I got to let you go, but I want to thank you for the time. And I want to congratulate you and Mark Johns on a spirited race that you end up winning by less than 700 votes. I know it's been a nail biter. Thanks for making time for us, and let's talk again soon.
Thank you so much, Evan. Here anytime.
Jen Lunsford, elected in the 135th New York State Assembly District. And that does it for another edition of Connections. The engineer of this program is Rob Braden. The producer is Megan Mack, and I'm Evan Dawson. Want to stress to you listeners, we've had the chance to talk to Mark Johns often over the years, and we hope we continue to do so. Jen Lunsford, the same. There are many political leaders in both parties who make time to talk to you, voters, listeners, and the public, and we think this is a great vehicle to keep doing that, and we only hope that continues. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.